As you might remember from way back at the beginning of July when we were worshiping over at First Christian Church, when we had our first week on Job, I said that I was a little worried about preaching on Job for a whole summer, because Job is such a bummer. Summer is a time of sunshine and adventure and having a great time with your family. Job's story is a winter story, and I was worried that it would hardly be an enticement to come to worship when you could be out kayaking or hiking. Oh, what's Gebby preaching on today? More Job. Oh gosh, I think we have somewhere else to be. It's understandable. Over the last few weeks, though, this congregation and members in it have suffered a series of devastating blows. There is serious suffering in our church. Cancer diagnoses, cancer treatment, emergency surgeries, loss of housing, loss of relationship, imminent death, and death itself. And I'm not somebody who thinks and will ever preach that the world is or should be some kind of fair place. I've never thought the world should be anything other than what it is, but I admit that in these last couple of weeks, the sheer volume of pain that you are walking around with has shaken me. And more than one of you now has come to me and said, "Does this mean I'm Job?" Or otherwise reference this sad and serious story. There is no right time to study the book of Job because the trauma that the poem describes will always come at what feels like the wrong time. Now you remember, Job doesn't start as a poem, right? It starts with this prose prologue, this little narrative that was tacked on to the beginning. And it says that God and the sons of God were at court, and suddenly they encountered an adversarial force. And so God challenged this adversarial force and said, "I dare you to prove that Job will not remain faithful to me." And so we meet Job, this very religious, very wealthy, and very anxious, worried man, who then loses his whole family and all of his assets to war and to natural disaster. But Job remains loyal and faithful to God. And so that first week I said I thought this was a completely false representation of God. That this beginning, this prologue, bore false witness to God, but in a way that's ultimately productive for us. This setup with the wager between destruction and God is a reminder of how often, even without thinking, we put God in the role of master planner or master puppeteer. It's very often our default position. We don't even realize we're doing it. It must be God's plan. But we know from our lived lives and the full breadth of our holy testimony to God that God does not go out of God's way to make our lives hard, let alone to take our children away from us. God is never trying to take our children away from us. And so we're reminded, oh, I did it again to God. By seeing again what is false, we are reminded of what is true. The story continues. Job has thrown himself onto an ash heap. He's gone to the dump, to the garbage pile, because now his whole body is falling apart. And there his friends, after a week of mourning, his friends begin to come to him. And his friend Eliphaz reminds him of the religious wisdom of the day, which is often the religious wisdom of this day, that good outcomes are the result of good deeds, and bad outcomes must be because of bad deeds. So Job, your suffering is clearly your fault. To which Job says, "No way." Job knows that he did right. Job knows that he did nothing wrong. And so in that moment, he lets go of the religious system on which he has based his entire life. He lets go the system on which he's based his entire daily life. Lets it go. And so we're invited to do the same. What are the systems, be they ideologies or practical systems, that are keeping us in places of pain or keeping others in places of pain? let them go. Now, Job didn't come to this place of revelation and realization easily or happily. He didn't go, gosh, wow, I was wrong. Okay, God, no problem. No, Job railed. Job was angry. He was hungry. He was in pain, and his babies were dead. Job yelled at God justifiably in indignation and with betrayal. Job was okay letting go his belief system and his system for daily life, but he didn't appreciate having to do that because of irrational and unjustifiable violence. And so then we move into the epic poem that is the bulk of Job, sandwiched between these more contemporary prose, prologue, and epilogue. Putting the conversation between God and Job in poetry, the ancient authoring community, by putting this conversation about what is right and what is wrong and what is the meaning of life in poetry, points toward the open-ended and interpretive process of seeking truth. Seeking truth is open-ended and interpretive. Us and God, we don't talk to each other in concrete linear ways. We speak to each other in metaphor and in fragments. We paint pictures of the world as it is and the world as it should be. We exchange sensations, colors, sounds, rhymes that reveal reasons. And the reasons, the reason that God has revealed to Job and all of us is that God's worries are not necessarily our worries. That God's understanding of justice is not exclusively our understanding of justice. While we're focused understandably on ourselves and our families, God is spinning the stars and playing with monsters. We hear all about Leviathan. The great scale of universal justice that God is negotiating that we can never understand is balanced on a point of cell division. The silence of space and the storm's beautiful song. God may not make the world just in the way we understand. But because we are in creation, because we are part of that stardust and cell division and carbon and creation. In the midst of that great weighing act, God is attending to us too. Even at our most wretched, when we are feeling most frayed, most vulnerable, and most alone, God is with us because God is within us. A few weeks ago, Carla and I were watching an old Jean Harlow movie, as one does on a Sunday afternoon. And Harlow's, and I don't know if you don't know who she is, she was an amazing comedian in the 1930s. Sure, 30s, let's call it 30s. Black and white, in the black and white times. And Harlow's character got some bad news, and she said, "Well, ain't that a bucket of clams?" And I thought, at last, I have a church-appropriate phrase to describe my reaction to the end of the book of Job. A bucket of clams, bilge water, hog wash. Because there is something rotten and stinky to the ending that we heard Jennifer read for us today. There's something wrong there. We've done all this work over all these weeks, throughout all of these chapters, to let go of comforting theologies of cause and effect. We've let go of that false net of comfort. We've accepted that God's powers and God's ways and God's language is more opaque and glorious than we can imagine. And we have now, at the very beginning of what Jennifer read today, joined Job in silent awe and saying, "Who is it that taught me wrong? How is it that I kept professing what was wrong? My ears had heard, but my eyes had not yet seen what you truly are. And so I repent and I recant, and I stay here before you, O God, in awe of your glory, in recognition of my size in the universe." And then what does God do? Become a magician again. In a moment, the story goes back to the prose, and we hear God chastising those crummy friends and saying, "Hey, if you'll just do the rituals right, we'll be friends again." That's exactly what the beginning said didn't work for Job. And then so Job is showered then with wealth, material goods. He gets money, he gets rings. And over some time, he has 10 more children, either with his first wife or another wife, we don't know. He lives a long life. He has lots of heirs. The end. A bucket of clams. This epilogue to the poem not only contradicts the poem, but it betrays Job. Job could never be restored. He could be rebuilt. Sure, over time, maybe he's got the magic touch and he could have rebuilt his material resources. But all of his children are dead. All of his original family is gone, and they could never be replaced. We know that. Someone we've lost can never be replaced. Job, or anyone, would be marked by such an experience. Anyone who's gone through that kind of hell would be changed forever by the experience. Once you've been through cancer and know what a dividing cell can do to your daily life, you are a different person. Once you've lost housing or a relationship, you may carry for the rest of your life the weight of worry and doubt. And once you've known intimately the reality of death and its permanence, those good days become more precious than ever before. Living the life that burst forth from God's womb marks us all. There is no going back to how things used to be. Not by our magical thinking, and not by God's power. The inclusion of this prologue and this epilogue demonstrates just how hard it is for us humans to accept that our lives are out of our control and not being controlled by God in the way that we want. Even though we have 40 chapters of God saying, "The world is wild and you are not at the center of it. I love you, but you're not at the center of it." Our predecessors felt the need to add this framework with a fantasy that we can blame God for all our problems and God will reward us if we just act right. It's that hard for us to receive God as God is. But there is one thing that this epilogue did really beautifully. "And all his male and female kinfolk, and all who had known him before came, and broke bread with him in his house, and grieved with him, and comforted him." They were late, but they showed up. Women and men brought their sorrow and brought their food. Family chosen and biological, bringing the comforts that we all know how to bring, our empathy, our love, and our food. Care, practical and spiritual, that's within our control. Those are within our power to offer. Those are not a bucket of clams. Those are the frankincense and the myrrh that the wise men brought to Mary. They are the scents. They are the beautiful scents of hope. My prayer is that for the days when you are on an ash heap, you are not surrounded by Eliphazes, trying to explain away the pain, trying to rationalize it, blame you, blame someone, but instead have kinsfolk chosen and born who will bring you comfort and will bring you food. And that on the days when you are strong enough, you will do the same for others. For every bit of bad news members of this community have received over the last couple of weeks, that is how you have responded. That is how you have responded with each bit of news of cancer, of loss, of imminent death. You have responded with comfort and food. We can't ever understand, because we are humans and we are not God, we can't understand the great universal scale that God is trying to balance out. But what we can do, and it's simple and it is not magical, is make sure that no one sits on the ash heap of sorrow and doubt alone. I told you at the beginning of July that I really love the book of Job. I love Job because it restores God to God's full dimension. God bursts forth from Job in the size that warrants our worship and praise. And I love Job because even though it illustrates again our shortcomings, it also lifts up our best habits of remaining faithful and showing up with food. There is never a wrong time to study the book of Job, because it is always the right time to let God be God and to take care of each other. Amen.